Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by Professor Laura Bishop. Laura is the Vice Provost for Research and Knowledge Exchange at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China. That's here.
Thanks, Mary.
And holds a PhD in anthropology from Yale University.
Which is not here.
Do you know that place?
I've heard of it, though.
Yeah, I've heard of it, too. Prior to joining UNNC, she was a professor of paleoanthropology and pro-vice chancellor for the Faculty of Science at Liverpool John Moores University.
She is the author of more than 60 scholarly publications, and her research explores the environmental context of the evolution of human behavior in Africa, with a focus on the interpretation of the dynamic aspects of hominin evolution, particularly behavior and ecology.
I love the way you change that to make my writing better.
I do my best, Mary.
In 2023, together with 31, I had to count them all.
That was impressive. Yeah, there's quite a list.
31 co-authors, Laura published the article, Expanded Geographic Distribution and Dietary Strategies of the Earliest Oldowan Hominins and Paranthropus in the journal, wait for it, Science.
Ooh, I'm especially impressed that you gave yourself all the Latinate terms here.
I've tried really hard to give them to you, Derek.
I'm terrible with Latin, I have to admit.
So, Derek, this episode, we've got a couple of firsts. I mean, first of all, we're probably in the most sciencey part of the social sciences.
Okay. Yes. Well, in fact, it intersects with some really strong hard science.
And also, we've got one of the big players here.
That's tonight. Right.
Okay. All right. So
Vice Provost of Research and Knowledge Exchange.
All the way from the Trent Building, right the way across.
It's so impressive sometimes. Do you feel like you're slumming?
No.
She paused.
Sorry, that was a terrible way to introduce
myself. I wasn't sure if you wanted an answer. That was rhetorical.
I've wanted to get one of our university leaders on the podcast for a while, you know, but certainly it does feel like the further up the kind of hierarchical chain you go, the less social science we have there in many ways.
It's heavily science oriented, but also the less time they have.
This is true.
Part of it.
But I also feel that is kind of a characteristic of universities generally, is that I do feel that the social sciences kind of misses out in those kind of very high levels. You know, it feels like, you know, we need proper sciencey people to run things rather than just sort of glorified hippies as we all are.
Or business people. They run the gamut though, right?
Moving on.
Okay.
Anyway. So I'm very pleased that we have Laura, and I'm very pleased that we do have this paper, which for me was quite a first. I know that you have done research into kind of, I don't know, early man? Have you?
Not so much early man, but I've looked at language evolution as reflected in non-human primates.
Okay. And how far back in history did you go or didn't you?
It depends which part of it you're talking about. So the split off from chimpanzees and bonobos and humans was, I mean, they're guessing 30 million-ish years ago.
Okay.
But that's, yeah.
Okay.
Can you correct this? Am I wrong?
The split between apes and humans.
Yeah. So the closest.
Between 8 and 12 million years.
Okay. So I'm
still,
way off.
But still a long time
yeah,
ago.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I love that we're bringing in our speaker to correct us.
As we should. I mean, it's been so long.
No, it's very cool that you know anything about this at all.
Well.
So. We actually don't.
Obviously, since I'm wrong, I don't know so much about it, but...
Well, I think this is the furthest back in history we've definitely gone on the podcast.
Certainly, yes. We're talking about millions of years, right? So,
and I do find it absolutely fascinating to learn about early us and the early ancestors of us.
Absolutely. I mean, and actually one thing I really appreciated about this article is it expanded somewhat our understanding of the timelines of where the locations of some of these hominids were.
And there are, like, finding these things out and specifying them actually has significant implications for understanding us today as well. You know, this isn't just something that's consigned to history. All of this has wider implications for our society now.
Absolutely. Now, we should ask the expert, because obviously we don't really know what we're talking about here. As
we have no idea.
Yeah.
But so, in general, not just today.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome, Laura.
Thank you very much, Derek and Mary. It is an absolute pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation. Thanks.
Do you think you can give us just a brief overview of this particular paper and the kinds of contributions that it was making? We tried to summarize, but I don't think we did it.
We failed miserably.
I think you did a really good job, actually.
Thanks.
So
oh.
Well done. And I particularly like the bit about the relevance of the story of human evolution to our lives today.
I
think it has a very important role to play in how we think about human unity, right?
Well, and what it means to be human and how we measure it in some way.
Quite. And, you know, I think everyone has this sort of basic desire to know more about where they came from. So this is our shared story. So anyway, the story of this paper is that it is a report on a new site that was discovered by our team some years ago. And it has been like mating elephants. It's a long time in the making to get this sort of thing. Archaeological.
Is that a metaphor that's used often?
You don't use that in your house.
You don't use that. Anything that takes a long time. Elephants have a 2-year gestation period. So we often use this term to refer to things that take a long time to percolate.
I'm definitely going to use this.
Absolutely.
I'll use it today.
I'll be checking after you. But anyway, I think this paper is quite unique because archaeology is destruction work, right? Mm. Once you dig it up, its original context is gone. So it's really incumbent upon all researchers who do this type of work to absolutely hammer it with the state of the art methodology. And that is really what this paper does. And because of that, we're able to explore, you know, all sorts of aspects of the remains that were found there. You know, you're absolutely right. It's a relatively old site. It expands the geographical range of a species, Paranthropus, that is often referred to robust Australopithecines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we think about hominids at this point in time, there are some with big teeth and small brains, and some with big brains and small teeth.
For our listeners, define what you mean by the term hominin?
Okay. A hominin is a direct member of our family, or our subfamily, actually. Mm-hmm. So we go back and forth in this type of field about the terminology, phylogeny, but these are humans and their closest relatives, right?
And there were a lot of these.
There were. And the tendency of the people who study them to split them up into different species is part of the reason for that.
You get extra credit if you find a new species, though, right?
Oh, yes. There's definitely an extra star on your star chart if you do find a new species. But personally, because I've got more ecological perspective, I'm more interested in what sort of things these guys were doing for a living. That tends to be broader categories, probably morphologically, in terms of shape and size, than you would use if you were just purely looking to define things as separate.
And there's some really neat findings in this paper about what these folk were doing at that time, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for complimenting them by using the term folk.
Given the capacity of what they were doing, how could you think of them otherwise?
Quite. I mean, I think the thing is that these are not people, right? These are, you know, people or animals that lived in the past that were probably in terms of their ability somewhere between chimps or bonobos and us, but they really did have complex behaviors. And I mean, I think the other thing is that even though we show that there is Paranthropus at this site, we aren't saying that they made the tools. Mm-hmm. Although there are many associations in the archaeological record between Paranthropus mm-hmm. and this old Dewan industry, which is not the earliest but sort of the most common early Stone Age industry.
Can you tell us about this site then? You began by talking about the site. Where are we in the world? And also, when are we?
Okay, so where are we in the world? We are on the shores of Lake Victoria.
That was very pastoral, sublime.
By the shores of Kitchigoobe.
Sitting comfortably, children.
It's on the shores of Lake Victoria. Lake Victoria is actually a recent lake, relatively speaking, but the part that we're on, which is an offshoot called the Wynnum Gulf, has more antiquity. And this actually, I'm sure you've heard the term of the Great Rift Valley, mm-hmm. right? But Lake Victoria is actually between the two branches of the Great Rift Valley, although it is still subject, that area, to a lot of geological activity. You've probably heard the term layer cake stratigraphy, and this is the idea that when deposits are laying down, they're all horizontal. Mm-hmm. We are a long way from horizontal here. The landscape is extremely choppy. Mm. But it's an area that we've been looking at. My colleagues and I, you know, my colleagues started in the 80s. I was a later joiner. But really, it's an area that was known to science from the 20s and 30s. Mm. That's 1920s and 30s, for those of you who have any confusion there.
We're not quite into the 30s yet.
Yeah, apologies. That's my age showing. So it's an area that's been known to science, but it is not an area that is particularly well known to science. And so these explorations since the 80s mm-hmm. and then much more intensively into the 90s have been happening in this whole region, which is known as the Hama Peninsula. And the site that is probably the best known is called Canjera. And you know, we were working there as part of a Smithsonian expedition, which was led by my colleague Tom Plummer in association with Rick Potts, who's the head of the Human Evolution Division mm-hmm. at National Museum of Natural History. So, you know, I got invited to join this project, first on a speculative, you know, basis. But the first time I went out there in the mid-90s, it was like, gold mine. You wow. know, this is such an amazing place and we haven't really explored it enough. Mm-hmm. So we spent many years sort of working on Canjera and studying it and publishing it. And then, you know, while we were doing this, we were also sort of taking little side trips to find other sites. And Nyanga was one of the sites we found. Often the local people say, oh yeah, we found some of these broken rocks and fossils over here, and they bring us there. And I think right. that was the case mm-hmm. with this place, which
when
is...
When you say local people, what modern-day countries are we talking about? Because there's a couple that...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is all... Although Lake Victoria spans at least three different countries, this is all on the Kenyan side. Okay. We're quite close to Uganda, to the Ugandan border, but this is all in Kenya.
And this is an area where some of the oldest evidence of sort of human habitation exists, right?
Well, I mean, all that whole area of mm-hmm. Africa has the oldest evidence. So depending on what you're looking at, either Ethiopia or Kenya or Tanzania are the mm-hmm. places that we have early evidence for. That's well dated, okay? Mm-hmm. South Africa also has very early evidence of human behavior and human presence, mm-hmm. But the dating there is more problematic. Contemporaneous, probably, but not so easy to put an absolute date on because of the absence of the volcanic materials, which are what we usually use to date. But there's been loads of work done on that. And often we treat them as separate arenas, but really it's highly unlikely that they weren't connected in the past. It's just we don't have the evidence for it.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of goes into a question I had, which is the kinds of evidence that we're looking at here to me is just amazing because it's geological in nature. We're talking about just stretches of time that are incredible. So things like the intervals of positive and negative polarities and things like that. So maybe you can expand on how these things are dated.
The sort of gold standard dating method that we use is we call absolute dating, and it's usually radiometric dating. Mm. And it's used on the basis of radioactive decay on elements that are present in volcanic rocks. Now, Sod's Law in the Hummer Peninsula, there's a giant volcano. So you're like, yes, this is going to be great for dating our site. But unfortunately, it's the wrong type of volcano. It's a carbonatite volcano, which doesn't eject the type of feldspars, that mineral that you need to date for this particular type of method, which, single crystal laser fusion, argon-argon dating is sort of the gold standard. Okay. That's a mouthful, isn't it? But anyway.
I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, that's okay. I've practiced that, actually, even though it didn't sound like that. Anyway, because of that, we have to do different types of dating. So some of the dating that's reported in that is experimental, and some of it is much more well-established, such as the paleomagnetism that you mentioned, and also biostratigraphy, right? So paleomagnetism is based on what we know about how the Earth's polarity shifts over time. And scarily enough, because, of course, all our modern devices will be absolutely up the swanee if this happens in our lifetimes. But the polarity of the Earth has shifted multiple times during the history of the Earth, sometimes briefly, in quotes, and sometimes over longer periods of time. And if you can measure this polarity in the sediments that you're looking at, you can try to match it up with the elastic rubber ruler that is the paleomagnetic time scale. And I say that because basically you're trying to match flips back and forth against flips back and forth. So really, they could be anywhere. And then you use other methods to anchor it. What you might know about the geological history of the area, which is pretty well established. We can also use what's known as biostratigraphy. Mm-hmm. And biostratigraphy is what we know about the animals that lived at a particular point in time. So if you know that you've got a reversed period and you might have a whole host of candidates for when that reversed period could be, you look at the animals that are present in the fossil record and you say, well, with those animals, it could only be this time. So basically, it's a multi-proxy method of dating. And it doesn't give us the precision of what might be for the gold standard radiometric dating, but it gives us a good ballpark. And when it comes to knowing something is older or younger, you can use that to establish things quite well. So
that was going to be my next question, was just how accurate are these methods? Because you sort of seem very kind of pleased with them, very proud of them. Laura gave a little fist bump at one point in that, during that tale. But how accurate are they? I mean, have we made big mistakes in the past?
I think every method has potential for mistakes. There's all sorts of different errors that can be introduced. When the radiometric dating was first introduced, which was years and years ago, it was done on whole rock samples, right? And we know because of volcanism that the rocks get cycled through and resourced. So basically you were getting an average date. Now, and this is the method that I will say one more time, single crystal laser fusion argon-argon dating.
That should be a new t-shirt for sure.
Yeah, really. But I know someone who'd wear it at the Berkeley Geochron Lab. But anyway, the method's in the name, right? So you're looking at the individual crystals. And that means you can sort of date a population of crystals, and then you can draw conclusions about what the most likely date is from that, if you see what I mean. So it's a far more accurate method, we believe, than just throwing chunks of rock in the grinder and getting an average sample. I'm sure I wasn't around when they were doing that, so I'm not sure if that's accurate.
Well, I'm fully understanding what you opened with, which is the notion that this is a destructive process. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. And once you dig it up, you destroy the context. And context is everything in archaeology. Mm. We do absolutely everything we can to maintain records of that context, loads of photographs, single point positioning in three-dimensional space with laser transits. Mm-hmm. And of course, now in the age of laser scanning, we could do so much more with, you know, scanning things as we excavate. So we've got the best record that we possibly can have. Mm-hmm. And of course, mm-hmm. archaeologists never dig everything up. We're very conscious that, you know, we're at a moment in time in terms of methodology. Mm-hmm. And we try to leave some behind for when better methods are devised. So, mm-hmm. you know, the hope is Nyanga in particular is in a highly erosive environment. So it's on a slope very close to the lake. Mm. And, you know, we can see every year that we go back the erosion that's happened because there are big river channels that go through there. Mm. And so you don't want, you know, saving it for posterity is one thing. Saving it for it to be washed into the lake is something else entirely. Mm. So it's a balance. It's
you mentioned you come back there every year. Do you go
pretty
back?
Much. The team does. Mm. There was a bit of a gap during COVID, obviously. Mm-hmm. Although our colleagues who lived locally, they walked around, took pictures because it is so highly erosive. New things are exposed every year.
When you say the team, do you mean all 31 of you?
and a few extra. Right. And I should point out, because, you know, of the context that we all work in, that was 32 authors from 7 or 8 different countries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, wow. we really had a very international team, and mm-hmm. that was integral to this success, really. I think one of the reasons this paper is so good is because we threw everything at it. we absolutely applied every method we could think of. And mm-hmm. that's what the paper itself is very short, but the supplemental material goes on for volumes. And that's why, you know, we can give a conclusion or a short description in the main paper, but mm-hmm. the supplemental materials gives a lot more detail as to the methodology, whether that's you know, paleosol carbonates mm-hmm. or whether it's the faunal analysis or the marks on the bone, the taphonomy, or whether it's the marks left on the tools by their usage.
These were all the pictures.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
That you have in the article.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why it makes such a compelling story. If you only publish one aspect of this, it's just like what my old thesis advisor, may he rest in peace, used to call another X from Y land. You know,
another one we can use. Derek.
Another X from
Y-land.
Yeah,
you know, this is a lot of discovery. More natural history papers are like that, aren't they? You know, I found this. Woohoo! It's cool. But you know, if you
divide a finding into several papers, so you can check that box.
I know, but it's so much more compelling to be able to do this sort of big bang paper. You know, it was so satisfying to see it all come together. I mean, one of the weirdnesses about this type of work is that you never really know the answer. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the evidence conflicts, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have to sort of either create a narrative which explains that or, you know, try to reconcile it in some other way. Okay. Mm-hmm. We try never to throw out data, right? We always try to find an explanation that fits the data, or sometimes it'll make you re-examine what you've done and say, did we do this right? And I always tell my students, you know, if you're one of those people who has to know the absolute truth, do something else.
Because philosophy. Oh, wait, absolute truth.
Probably the closest worst advice.
Yeah, I'm full.
Well,
of terrible
you know,
advice.
I don't want to get any philosophers offside because you know it's a very useful thing to think about. But
absolutely.
Yeah, you know, it's not like pure math or physics where you know that somewhere there is an answer there, or lots of other scientific fields. It really it's an historical science. Right? We can do modern experiments like ethnoarchaeology and try to replicate what happened in the past, but we just don't get a do-over, you know?
Well, and we make comparisons, for example, as you were saying, to capacities of non-human primates or great apes, but that doesn't actually tell us about the evolution of species. All it does is it gives us a comparator in the present, right?
Absolutely true. You know, modern analogs can be used and they're very illuminating, but, you know, it's always a leap to say that this is the way things happened in the past. Everything has changed. You know, so, the past is a different country, right?
We're getting a lot of quotable quotes today.
Yeah, that one's not mine. No, that one's not mine.
So the people or the human-like animals, perhaps, that you were investigating at this site, they're called the Oldowan, right?
The Oldowan is a stone tool industry that is named for Olduvai Gorge, where it was originally discovered.
Ah.
Okay. It's characterized as a pebble tool industry.
Okay.
So basically, pebbles are where you start. And when I say pebble, I mean big pebble, right? Cobbles. And flakes are knocked off of those. The tool is either the flakes or the main rock.
So that explains the title of the paper, The Oldowan Hominins.
Right, exactly. And that explains also that we didn't automatically connect the Oldowan hominins with the Paranthropus that we found, if you see what I mean. Mm. It's the assumption, remember I told you, big brain, smaller teeth, small, you know, small brains, big teeth. The assumption's always been that the genus Homo, the guys with the bigger brains, were the ones making the tools, right? Mm-hmm. But we have this association. The hominins we found at that site are Paranthropus. They're the little brain, big teeth guys. And they
seem... I know some of those guys.
Why did you look at me when you said that?
Well, no name calling here. We're all happy hominins. And, you know, so that was one of the sort of surprises. We'll never know for sure who made the darn things. I mean, even if you found one, you know, fossilized with a stone tool clutched in its hand, doesn't necessarily mean
sort of
it made
it.
Exactly. And, you know, certainly later on in the archaeological record, there are instances where people think that different types of hominid are sort of making cultural copies off of each other. Mm. But, you know, these are not attractive artifacts. They're just broken rocks. If you found one in your rock garden, you would not think, oh, I've got a stone tool here. You'd think, oh, this cobble broke during delivery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why we have to be very careful about the context where they're found. So if you find broken rocks in a river valley, then it could be the river broke them. But if you're finding them where they're an unusual size of sediment in the sedimentary environment, then you can assume that they got there because someone put them there.
And with the kind of bones that they might have been tearing apart with these tools, or because you also find percussive tools,
exactly.
Right? So it's not just the flaking, but it's, you know, there's...
That's absolutely right. I mean, you don't have to flake a rock to break something with it. Mm. And we find these tools and cobbles, less modified cobbles, that have percussion damage on them. So you can see where they've been whacked, essentially. And you can see the signs of whacking on bones. Whacking, I just want to point out, that is the technical term.
That's good.
But, you know, you can see signs of percussion damage, which sounds a lot more professional, on these bones. And once again, this is something we've done experimental work on. There's a huge literature of this to try to create a reference whereby you can identify these marks on fossil bones. Obviously, the preservation of the bones has to be very nice in terms of, you know, it's not, the surface isn't eroded, it hasn't been mixed around in, you know, to use the previous example, river gravel, which will make like a rock tumbler. Yeah. And so really, that's one of the things that makes this site so nice, is that the bones are pretty much in a primary context, as we say. They haven't been shifted around. They are where they croaked it, whether they were killed or whether they were scavenged.
But butchered, right?
But butchered.
It certainly seems that that's the case. And also plant stuffs as well, right?
Yeah, we don't find the actual plant stuffs in the form that they would have been when they were processed, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't find like a hunk of potato peel or something equivalent, you know.
That would be remarkable.
That would be super remarkable. We could talk about the domestication of the potato, which was not in Africa 3 million years ago. But you see what I mean. What we find are plant remains in the form of pollen or phytoliths in the soil. And also, you know, there is a move to look for them in the actual sort of scratches that are made on the stone tools.
Now, one of the findings here as well is an indication of a diet rich in C4 foods. Maybe you can unpack that a little bit, because I understood C4 foods as related to agriculture, but...
Ah, that's great. No, you've made a really good leap there. Yeah, C4 plants are largely tropical grasses, mm-hmm. right? And certainly
like
for...
sorghum, like maize.
Like maize.
Yeah,
like
well, maize is the big one in North America.
Maize is the big one in North America, right? So C4 grasslands are tropical grasslands. And, you know, American and North American diets are very rich in corn, not only because we eat corn, but also the animals we eat corn. So there's a lot of C4 floating around in a North American diet, and increasingly so everywhere. But, you know, C4 plants are more than grass stems. They're also seeds, and also, for a lot of them, underground storage organs. So grass, corms, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, if animals are eating that, if hominins are eating that, we're not thinking they're, you know, chomping down on grass like cows. We don't have the digestive system for that anywhere in human evolution. But it's far more likely that they're, you know, processing other aspects of C4 plants.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So that seems to be the sort of findings of the paper, are that there is this more diverse diet of these creatures. And also, notice that I say creatures now. These folk, to use the Canadian term.
Very inclusive, I love it.
A more diverse diet, and we're also a little bit more widespread than we thought.
That's right.
What are the implications of those findings? Why is it important that we know this?
Well, it's important because it means that the capacity for technology might very well have, you know, originated earlier and be more widespread in terms of the different taxa that were doing it. And that means that it was probably an adaptation that helped hominins deal with variations in the landscape and variability through time. Right? Landscapes vary through time and space. And anything that you have beyond your, you know, your body, anything sort of extracurricular there, extra somatic, as we might say, that you can bring to bear on that is something that potentially allows you to exploit more. I mean, the other interesting thing is that we know that they were capable of making judgments about the type of rocks that they used for the stone tools, right? And they often carried them from places where they found them to places where they used them. And this speaks a lot about their cognitive capacity in terms of being able to plan ahead. They had no pockets. Right. So carrying these rocks around, whether it was done by hand or whether there was some other extra somatic device that they could use to carry more of them, was something that involved a considerable investment of time, of thought, of energy. So, you know, I think that really speaks to a certain amount of nous there in terms of, you know, we might need these later. They aren't where the animals are. Let's bring them to the animals.
Because you know, even an affective dimension. I mean, I'm imagining having a favorite rock that I want to.
You haven't
take
got a favorite rock, Darren?
I don't at present.
I don't know. I think everyone should have a favorite rock.
I fully agree with you. I feel a loss in my life right now.
So this is fascinating listening to you, and you clearly know these folk and this area particularly well. So it's really interesting listening to you talk about this. Can you tell us what is the most significant thing that you think you found out here? Because you've clearly spent some time in this part.
Well, thank you for your compliment there. I really appreciate you saying that.
There's many more to come, Laura.
Well, you know, my actual area of expertise in this area is the animals, right? So that's what I mostly work with myself, is the fossil animals and that are associated with the humans, because that's my part of the piece, is the environment. I do less on the behavior or the diagnosis of the species, et cetera, et cetera.
But that's super fascinating, too. I mean, the idea that these are somehow hominids that are capable of taking down these hippopotamid animals is, to me, extraordinary.
Yeah, giant animals. Really.
Or are these mini hippopotamus?
No. These are full-size jobbies. And in fact, some of them are.
Some of the most dangerous animals on Earth.
They absolutely are. But we're not saying that they hunted them.
Sure.
You know, we're so close to the water here, potentially, that, you know, they might have just died of natural causes.
just gave up.
I don't know. I mean, hunting a hippo, as you correctly point out, is something that you know, is not something undertaken lightly by these tiny little things with, you know, without big claws or, you know, pointy teeth.
How tiny little things? How tall were they?
Well, there's a range. Okay. There's a range from sort of, sorry, now you're going to make me think of metric, but, you know, from about a meter tall to, you know, meter and a half or so. But, you know, we don't know exactly. It's all inference. We can.
Why did they disappear? Do we know that?
Well, I mean, they disappeared in the sense that they, many of them, well, at least one lineage evolved into us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, probably the environmental conditions changed beyond what they were able to cope with. Mm-hmm. It may just be that as different daughter tacks evolved, they outcompeted them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's hard to know. We never see the full picture of these things. I mean, just recently I was looking at a paper that said there was no evidence that human behavior caused the extinction of large mammals, large herbivores in Africa, which is good. I'm glad we didn't get off to our killing foot that early, you know, that killing spree that early. But the environmental conditions in these places change and fluctuate. And, you know, and there's capacity that you have within a generation to accommodate that and also not. And also, remember, there were lots of things with pointy teeth and big nails that were looking for dinner. And I'm sure, what's a hominin going to do?
Climb
up a tree.
I like the idea of little snippets of history in this way. And so you get all of these little snippets. And then if you get enough, you start forming a narrative, it seems. I'm still interested in your most significant find, because I think you're about to tell us.
I don't know. I mean, personally, I think the significant bits are in the headline. Right. We've got this old Devon industry. It's very old. It's in a different place. It's associated with a different type of hominin that we normally associate it with, at least in terms of the sort of received narrative of human evolution. So, you know, I think those are the significant aspects of this paper. But what makes it a wonderful paper is really that we can put all of these different lines of evidence to it. And if you think about the sort of multiple types of evidence you get from a site, you know, you can get the fossil humans, you can get the stone tools, you can get the animals they lived with, you can get other environmental data from the sediments.
And this is why it requires 32 people.
Thank you for pointing that out. Sometimes I look at an astronomy paper, which has, you know, more authors on it than it has pages. And you just think, wow, all these people. But then if you know anything about the technology involved, you realize that it is not the occupation of a one-man band. Mm-hmm. Very much the same for this. If you're going to get that type of comprehensive paper, you really need to pull in the skills. This paper wouldn't be what it was without each and every one of those people. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there are people who are questioning the interpretation of whether it actually is a Paranthropus tooth, because they really, you know, have a big, you know, cognitive dissonance with the idea of potentially Paranthropus making them. Does, you know, Paranthropus could have been dinner. We don't know, you know, but it was there and we have no signs of anything else other than the tools. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there are always going to be differences. It could be, you know, differences in dating methods. It could be these people don't know what they're doing in terms of looking at the microtraces of tools. Mm-hmm. It could be Laura got the taxa wrong and therefore, you know, the biostratigraphy doesn't work. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think the thing is that we tend to disprove things rather than re-examining them by the next discovery. Do you see what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And then so the next discovery comes around and, you know, makes you, it can be either confirming or, you know, putting you more in a position to question these things.
Mm-hmm. That's the scientific method in a nutshell.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say in these contexts, because it's not, you know, it's not Popperian science that you can do experiments and repeat and, you know, prove a hypothesis that way. it's really difficult to finalize these things. And, you know, I don't think
pretty good job, Laura.
Well, you know, this was only 2023, right, that this was published. There's still plenty of time for, rather it was us to say it was wrong, but, you know, or other people to say it was wrong.
That's moving into my next question, which was ultimately, what do you hope will be the implications of the paper, and what conversation do you think will have been started by it, or would you like to come out of this?
Well, I mean, I think what we have out of this is, you know, the amazing range of capacity, whether it's cognitive or behavioral, that these hominids had at this point of time. As I said, the association between Paranthropus and stone tools is as old as, you know, as long as we've known Paranthropus. There was always a better candidate in the wings, you know, in terms of brain size to have done this amazing thing. But, you know, we know now that crows make tools, right?
Well, capuchins
are
quite capable. And,
exactly.
And the bonobos we worked with flake tools.
Yes.
So they can master these types of skills.
Absolutely. And therefore, you know, there isn't the same sort of pressure to think of tool making as a uniquely human characteristic. So I think that's something that will happen. I think also, you know, what we learn about is the different environments that hominids were capable of existing in. Now, what we find in terms of environments is completely potluck, right? Because no one goes out with a backhoe to dig up East Africa or South Africa to find things. You find them because the geology reveals them to you. Someone trips over them or goes looking for them intentionally.
Or riverbeds reveal them.
Exactly.
Or,
yeah. You know, erosion or our wonderful local people, because, you know, they not only do the walking around and everything and living there and, oh yeah, look over there, but they also do a lot of the excavation.
Mm.
They work for us over the summers when we're there, and they're highly skilled. I mean, a lot of these chaps, you know, their day job is farming or fishing, but when we come, they come and work for the project, mm-hmm. you know, in association with the National Museums of Kenya, and do all of that work, which, you know, we couldn't do any of this without them. But I think that's it. It's a conversation. And to be able to contribute to that conversation, which just only seems to get broader. You know, it's not a narrowing conversation. And that's really what I like about it. I mean, it's always a tightrope in terms of, well, my pet theory is this and my pet theory is that. But, you know, I think that
sounds like a group of academics together.
Does it not? So. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I think the thing is that we have to accept that there's variability and range. And I think exploring the sort of edges of that is really important for understanding the sort of dynamics of human evolution in terms of the directionality it seems to have taken and, you know, where we are today.
And where to seek evidence next, potentially.
So that, where? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this is kind of our final question is what next? So, you know, where can you go? You're saying you go back every year or try to.
Yeah. What are your plans now?
What are the plans?
Because we want to have you back, obviously.
Before the next paper. Well, yeah, I've been doing this more years than I care to count. The field work is definitely part of it for us because, you know, but many of the people on that paper would have never been in the field with us. They would have just done the secondary analyses or tertiary analyses because, you know, don't get me started on how long it takes between starting a project and getting a result. But, you know, I think because this region of Kenya and sort of the Rift Valley is so unusual in terms of its geological context, both today and in the past. You know, we continue to explore it and, you know, we're finding new sites every time we go. The question really is, do we pivot and focus on that? Or do we, you know, do more in the sites we know? Sometimes, you know, the bird in the hand is a very, very tempting thing, right? Because you know you've got great things from there and you don't know what more you'll find. And sometimes you say, well, you know what? this is enough excavation. And,
oh, it's never enough. You never say that, really.
No, we really do. We really do. Sometimes with enough. We have dug enough big holes here. And, you know, of course, Sod's Law, you know, it could always be the next place you dig. We have jokes in the field, and not just us, but other teams of researchers, that you always find the best thing on, like, the last day, just when you're trying to close everything up and leave. So, you know, this is a well-known phenomenon. But yeah, I mean, our plans for this summer are to go back and to do more work at Nyanga, but also at two other sites, which I hope you'll be hearing about in the future.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, we look forward to hearing about those, and we really hope that you will come back to share your findings with us.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you guys today. I really appreciate the invitation, and I would be delighted to, whenever in another 20 years when we have something else to say.
Thank you so much for making time for us, Laura.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge, and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.